I discovered something.
A pocket?
There are two pockets that I didn't know about that go along the seams.
What a find.
Yeah, no, it's great. Because now, in my other robes, the way the sleeves are sewn up in the kimono, it's a little bit too shallow. And when I put my glasses in and I bow, like I'm tumbling out. So this I can just put on my hip and bow with impunity.
What freedom.
Yeah, amazing, you know? Totally amazing.
New Jersey.
Yeah.
Totally New Jersey.
Yeah. So, you know, always close. And some would expect us to be always close to something. Not like always close to nothing. I think by now we've met some resistance. We met some aches and pains. Our spine, our neck, the schedule. The schedule, what's remarkable about the schedule is it keeps coming. You know? I compare it to a, you know, they have these gizmos you can buy, clip onto the bottom end of your toothpaste. You keep rolling it. And I imagine this is what the schedule does to us. Squeezing the toothpaste out. And we're the toothpaste and we're like, no, here it comes. It's like those cartoons where the steamroller's coming at the guy and they get flattened into the asphalt. Then they get up afterwards. Their life forever changed. You know, most of our lives is like, Godzilla, you know, the monster arrives and we're these people that are running away from the monster. And the monster just sort of plodding along. You
know. Minding its own business.
Inevitably, just one step after the other. And there are people looking back and screaming and running, running as fast as they can. And yet the monster is just sort of going like this and catching them. And we're falling over, you know. I think of the lady, in, you know, running through the woods, tripping over logs and looking up. So, toothpaste rollers and Mothra. and suffering. What are we close to? We're getting very close to suffering. So we never forget it. So we're always present. This is what Dongshan is close to. Always close. Never far away. Never abstract. Present to the heart of the matter. You know, we actually, if we didn't suffer, we wouldn't be human beings. Now, suffer, you know, it's not like... I mean, there's big suffering, yes. There's suffering like Aleppo, Syria, Afghanistan. But for most of us, suffering is like, it's too cold, or it's too warm, or I'm hungry. Or it's, this isn't good enough. I'm not good enough. I always make mistakes. I need someone else. This doesn't satisfy me. It always makes me think of, to date myself, the Talking Heads song, how did I wake up in this house and have this beautiful wife, all this stuff. But that's all around us. Look at Monmouth County. Fast ferry to Wall Street. The Range Rovers and the horse boots. I think any number of psychotherapists can talk to the suffering of Monmouth County. The suffering of trying to escape suffering. The suffering of turning away and running to some place. There's, if I remember correctly, I know that there's a Buddhist book called Don't Turn Away, or Not Turning Away, something like that. And it's a compendium of a group of Buddhist teachers. If memory serves correctly, it has to do with socially engaged Buddhism. But really, do not turn away is essential to anything we do here in our lives. We're always turning away. We're always imagining something else. We're separating ourselves and moving ourselves away from always close. But we're always close, even if we're acting like we're not. So this sitting, is really meeting this resistance to our closeness. And it takes many forms. Sometimes it actually takes the form of being a perfect Zen student. Of knowing what to do when and doing all the rituals. Other times it takes the form of the revolutionary, rebellious Zen student who says, I'm not going to bow. I said to someone earlier, you know, I didn't say it exactly like this, but you know, there were probably about 5 to 7 years in the beginning when I just sort of bowed. I thought, this is what you do. And then there was this long period where it's like, oh my God, bowing again. I've got to bow. I don't want to bow. My knees hurt. My back hurts. There's all this stuff. Why am I bowing anyway? All this is important. So the point being that, you know, we think these forms are, they are like oh, you just do them and the better you do them, the more you do them that you think, oh, I'm closer to Buddha than thou. Really, this whole thing is set up to meet our resistance, to meet our suffering, to be present to it all the time, or as much as we can bear, because it's hard to bear. At some point, a couple of years ago, there was an article in the New Yorker about a Japanese Zen monk. And he was describing his, what I'll call a breakthrough experience. And if you read it, you would be horrified. it wasn't like the universe opened and God reached down and said, hey, everything's okay. He went through some really rigorous training and was under great stress and tension. And then I think he was carrying some large pot one day in a temple in Japan. And he couldn't go any further. He was totally physically and mentally exhausted. And he kept going. And his life changed. He somehow let go. And then he started this practice where he helped. You know, suicide's a big deal. It's a big deal here in this country. In Japan, it's a big deal too. A lot of people committing suicide. So he started doing suicide counseling. And he was like, he would just go help people wherever. Helter, skelter. And thought he could do that. And he was very helpful to people, and so much so that he was completely, again, exhausted. Totally wiped out. Said, about, again, ready to give up and not do this. He went away into the countryside, into some small temple that had been abandoned. Small Zen temples are being abandoned all over Japan, because there's no money and no patrons and no people who practice Zen. So he went there and he lived there. And then he realized he still wanted to help people. So then he started, he made it clear that people could come to this temple. But they had to follow certain rules, they had to do certain things. They had to show that, as they say in capitalism, they had some skin in the game. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest things in capitalism over the last 30 years is nobody has any of their skin in the game. They have our skin in the game, and they gamble with it. Mm-hmm. So what he found was he, in the first portion of this attempt to work with people, people were using him in a way. And in the second portion, he was able to take care of himself and provide a form for people to come to. And a way for them to make a commitment, and also take the emphasis of participating off their self issue, their personal psychological story. And he found he could help more people. I'll have to, I know I saved the PDF of the article. I found it very poignant. This big question, you know, what is it? Where is the technique to help people? That's from the introduction yesterday that I read. Jifeng, cutting off his tongue, made a sequel to Shi Shuang. Cao Shan, cutting off his head, didn't turn away from Dongshan. The ancients' sayings were so subtle. Where is the technique to help people? Not to turn away from others. We have to learn how not to turn away from ourselves. Not to go someplace else. When we meet resistance, when we meet discomfort. So back to our friend's suffering, you know, the big neon sign, suffering. Woe is me. But suffering, again, is much more subtle, much more nuanced. Sometimes much more oblivious. I was reading a piece by Trungpa Rinpoche where he's talking about things like fidgeting. You know, you sit down with somebody at a table and they're shaking their knee against the leg. Or putting their hand in their pocket, doing something. We're all sort of doing this. So we stand someplace at a bus station. When's the bus going to come? Damn bus. Public transportation never works around here. Naturally thrown to blame and not to be present. Not to be present with the concrete and the other cars, the people walking by. Maybe the biggest thing we can do is to learn how to be present with ourselves. And then to cart that around with us, wherever we go. In the Starbucks line. I'm naturally a pretty impatient guy. There are all sorts of things. I'm naturally an angry guy, an aggressive guy, a violent guy. I realized this when I was, 18. So I hightailed it to the monastery. But 40 years later, this is 6 years ago, 35 years later, I met someone from my high school. Found me. She lived in New Hampshire and was in Massachusetts and so on. So we got together. And then she got me to go to the 40th. I hadn't been back to my hometown for 40 years to go to my high school reunion. This is just a way to say we're all people here. And we have histories and ways of being and habits. But so I was resistant to go back. But she became really good friends with my wife. The next thing I know, I was at my 40-year reunion with my wife. On the way down drinking Cosmos. She makes really great Cosmos. So, And there I was at some country club, yacht club type place on the south shore of Long Island where they were having this gathering. In some town, I think it was a place called Sayville, Long Island. And there were all these people. And at that time, I had a long, wavy, gray-white hair and a big beard. I think I had a beard. Maybe I had shaved it off by then. At any rate, I was outstanding.
Do you have any pictures from that time?
Yeah, there's probably a picture on Facebook of me.
There is. Unrecognizable.
Yeah. And there I was. And the first, not exactly the first person, but one of the first or second persons I met was my football coach from 40 years ago. And I remember giving a big embrace and hugging him and it feeling for him a little bit too close. I think I even did something really weird, like put my hand behind his neck or something. And he got a little fidgety. And then my Jessa was standing next to me and I introduced him to Jessa. And he said, "Do you know how violent and aggressive this man is?" Jessa said yes. She didn't toss in crazy, but so the first thing to pop into this guy's brain after 40 years, right?
And that's the football coach saying it.
Yeah. It's not like, just some nice guy. It wasn't like my English teacher saying it. Yeah. And for being that, they a few years later, it put me in the Sports Hall of Fame for being vicious and aggressive. Violent. Legally. But it's a funny thing, without that form I would never have made it through high school. If I couldn't have exhausted myself that way, I would never have gone to school. It's not that I didn't like learning and so on, it's just that school seemed a useless endeavor. So that's just to say, this shit is in all of us. And like our friend, the monkey warrior, it never goes away. Constant vigilance, being present every moment, wherever we are standing. And it's our choice. It's like the wild fox koan, which I think is in here too, a version of it. At every moment we have a choice of 500 lifetimes as a fox, 500 lifetimes of elegance. The elegance here is not like being well coiffed or nice fingernails or those special shoes with the red soles. It's being gentle and kind. It's being present. It's being able to be with ourselves and with others. It's being able to respond. Lunchtime calls. And how do we develop the capacity to respond by this seemingly strange discipline of attempting to sit still, and not just follow our thoughts, what we think are our thoughts, what we think are our emotions, what we think are our feelings, what we think we need at that very moment. And getting up and acting on it. It's actually, when we're experiencing this resistance, sitting here, whatever it is, like, this is so boring, this is stupid, this is, I'm so angry. Why does he have to walk like that? If he hands me that sutra book like that again, these are thoughts that we have all the time that we never know we have. Or we act on. We actually tell somebody, you shouldn't hand that sutra book to me that way. But we sit here with it. We are, what's it called? It's somewhat similar to being basted.
Marinated?
We're marinating in our own resistance. We're stewing. And what happens is a chemical process is going on. We're cooking. We're dissolving. This body sitting here is like a pot. A lot of stuff in it. And it's cooking. We provide the heat. Our anger, our fear, our resistance. Resistance and friction creates heat. And it's cooking. It's a slow cook. And it transforms us. And it takes a lot of energy. Many people think they're going to go to a retreat, a Zen retreat, and I'll just relax and I won't have to eat so much and I'll lose weight. I'll be able to sleep. And then we're confronted with how much energy it takes just to sit still and sit up straight. It's like... there have been times when I've been with people who they sit down and they just start shaking. Just like this. Ed Brown used to do that. It was incredible. And he's this wonderful guy who cooks a lot. He's this incredibly generous and creative fellow, loving fellow. Remember he talked with, I think it was Katagiri Roshi about him. Katagiri, before Katagiri was Roshi, right? Katagiri was at that time a youngish Zen priest, but actually old for a Zen priest because he went into the Zen world older. Most of these guys start when they're like 12 or 13, seriously, because they're the son of and things like that. Or at latest 18 or 19. And Katagiri, I think it was after the war, he'd been in the war, and maybe he was 28, something like this, so he started a little later. But he worked out a program with Ed so Ed could walk and sit. But still, he shook a lot. The energy is powerful. It takes courage to face Mothra, to face our monsters. It takes energy to go mining, to go into our pit. The resistance is like, oh, I don't want to go down there. No, I refuse. I don't want to go there. Or it may just be simple, oh, that's uncomfortable. I don't want to be. But there's this place where we can learn to be with where our breath stops, where our thoughts stop, where our emotion turns to anger or distaste. And we can, it's a little bit like applying energy healing to ourselves, you know? There's the sort of, is this Reiki where you don't exactly touch the body? But it sort of like brings the energy out and the hand brings it together. So the resistance there, we take our breath there, and it's like that space creating a warmth and friendship with our resistance. Not going at it with a jackhammer. You know, being friends with our sacrum. Being friends with our hip. Being friends with us. So in Dogen's, I forget the exact title, Bodhisattva's Four Guidances, he talks about giving. One of the main givings that I feel is giving ourselves to ourselves. And then he says, it's only when we give ourselves to ourselves that we can allow other people to give themselves to themselves. And the greatest gift of this practice is to help people give themselves to themselves. But we don't do that by acting on them. We do that by acting on ourselves. We do that by exercising constraint and discipline on ourselves and becoming aware of our own resistances, our own fears, and our own anger. If you'd like to lie down, Jeannie, you can lie down. Don't worry.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, good. Okay, don't worry. We have to, it's like creating a sanctuary for ourselves, our body, our presence. Where we can be sensitive, where we can be aware. This place opens up by the courage and the effort, the discipline, the constraint, the simplicity of an experience like sitting on the sabotan and sitting together. And each of us sitting together, making this effort, just making this effort, each one of us, in our unique life, on our unique zavatan, on our unique cushion or chair. That effort helps everyone else in the room. Without getting up, adjusting people, saying this is what you should or shouldn't do, I have a solution for you, without fixing everything. This is where we emerge when we make this effort. This is how we know one another. By this effort. And we know the difficulty. We know it in ourselves. And we experience it without focusing on it in other people. We feel the effort people are making. And it's courageous, and it creates respect and awareness. It doesn't create it, it allows it to arise. And mostly we're interfering with life. We're intruding. We're having surgical strikes that have a lot of collateral damage. We're not simply being present with ourselves. And this ourself that we're present with is interdependent, co-arising with everything else. That truck on the road, the stained glass windows, the clouds, the coolness of the room. Coolness I feel on my fingertips, and each of us might feel some other sensation. These are all interrelated, and we're not separate in that way. So Dongshan is always close, I'll call it this to this. And it starts with really recognizing the First Noble Truth. Life is suffering. Life is dukkha. And out of that incredible, powerful love arises. Right through our body. And all this resistance and this tightness and difficulty in our body. Sometimes I describe it as like, remember that movie Aliens? The mm-hmm. Alien? Mm-hmm. And that thing that, whatever it was called, bursts out of them, you know. Of course, that thing was supposed to be evil. And it was pretty scary. The first time I saw Aliens was at Presbyterian Hospital in San Francisco. I was a young priest. This is 82, so I don't know. Maybe it's 80, something like that. I was there. Do you remember Gloria Simino? Jay Simino's wife? Sister? No?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So Gloria was working at Presbyterian Hospital with in the children's cancer world. She was a sociologist. Yeah. So I was there with her visiting them one night, and we were watching Aliens, all of us together. And the kids didn't find it scary. They were quite accustomed to Aliens. They were all bald, you know. They were all possibly not going to live very long. But I remember when that thing popped out, I was like, whoa. But, you know, and of course the alien thing was, it's other. But most of us, our actual life is alien to us. And we're not open in our body and our mind to life. And with this discipline of sitting and being present and being mindful and breathing and being present with our resistance, we're actually resisting life emerging. And the degree to which we resist life emerging is the degree to which we're messed up. That our views are topsy-turvy. That we used to call it, in the Heart Sutra, it was translated as perverted, but I think people started getting sexual connotations about that. But really, perverted means thoroughly perverted, turned. So, where was I? Oh, I was with John at his class. And the, at Long Island University. And the, what would the student ask? Who would they forgive, or what would they forgive? Or what was the question, John, about forgiveness?
Well, the opening question for the semester was, what would you like most to forgive in your life?
And what
that
were
could be what, who, and
yeah,
however.
Yeah, exactly. And what were, what was the majority of answers?
Myself. I could forgive myself.
Yeah. These are 18 to 20 year olds?
Yeah.
So, forgive, one way of looking at forgive is that for is an intensifier. Like per or these other. So you could say that forgive is to thoroughly, to completely give.
I love that. That's
yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is what Dogen's addressing here, at giving ourselves to ourselves. But it's also what Dana Paramita is about. The perfection of giving is. Excuse me?
Generosity.
Yes, generosity. It's completely giving without measure and without leaving no trace. There used to be a verse, and I think there still is, I think we have a shortened version of the meal chant here, that used to say, no gift, no giver, and no receiver. So there's no measurement of what's happening. There's no, as we talked about, categorization yesterday, there's no measurement in categorizing and separating. So the Bodhisattva's life is about giving without expectation of return. The yoga is giving. The yoga is generosity. And the response, the result is, over time, as we let go of expectation, is nourishment. And this has the same process of giving ourselves to ourselves on these cushions, or standing at the bus stop. How do we do this? We don't know, but we have some good practices, forms that have been passed on for a few thousand years, a couple of thousand years, 2.5. And in the Zen world, maybe since, I don't know, 5th century China. But then, of course, there's antecedents to Zen and the organization in Central Asia and in India. So these are practices that are passed on from generation to generation of people. These are questions that are shared and turned over. And they've had effect on people's lives. And so we do these practices, and we share, and we consider whether our virtue and practice, we reflect. And by the way, we fail. But if we didn't try, we would never fail. One of the biggest issues I find in well, in life, of course, and in my own life, but in students' lives at Wellesley Colleges, they're all afraid to fail. To a person. And not only are they afraid to fail, they're afraid to get a B. And that limits them so much. It limits us so much that we're afraid to appear to fail. That so this is the guy in the wild fox's problem. He was asked, I forget, this is a Zen master free of causality, we'll say it. And he said, yes. Sorry, you're a human being. So he was condemned, like our friend the monkey, to 500 lifetimes as a fox. Then he would appear at the same monastery that he'd been at 500 lifetimes ago, whenever, and be in the back of the room when I forget the teacher's name.
Hyakujo.
Hyakujo. Hyakujo. Yeah. Bajang.
Bajang.
Yeah. Was giving, yes. Was giving his talk. And then as Bajang would leave, like I leave first, Bajang would leave first, and the guy would disappear. And then one day he was there. And Bajang sort of like asked him who he was and what's up. And he said, 500 lifetimes ago or some, you know, ages ago, I was here and I was the abbot of this monastery, and a student asked me, is a Zen master free of causality? And I said yes, and ever since I've been condemned to this rock behind the monastery. It's a fox.
One wrong answer?
One wrong answer. Yeah. You know, the ante gets higher and higher the further along you go.
Worst wrong answer.
Yeah. but it's all readable in how he said it. And Bajang's response, Hyakujo's response was, a Zen teacher must always be aware, something like that, of causality.
Must not ignore
causality. Must not ignore causality, yeah. So this is incredibly important. That's why we have this choice. The choice of 500 lifetimes as a fox, ignoring causality. Or the choice of elegance, being truthful, authentic, and genuine in our life, in our moment, without hesitating, without prevaricating, without thinking, oh yeah, I'm a Zen master, I'm free of causality. That's not true. We're not that imagined thing. We're already imagined, but we are what we are. And this discipline and this yoga is about sitting in our own stew. It's not stewing like we generally think about it, you know, like stewing. What's she doing? Stewing. It's actually enjoying our juices. It's being fully engaged with the juice of our life. It's being fully aware of you know, so I shave my head every 4 or 5 days, and I'm more aware of how my hair grows. I mean, you know, I shaved actually Thursday morning, and today's Saturday, you know, hair's coming back. I'm aware of that. Tom mentioned when giving the introduction to Shishin in the old days, not so long ago, you know, when I was a Zen student at a monastery, we didn't bathe for the 7 days. So you got very familiar with perspiration, with oily skin.
And everyone else's.
And everyone else's. You found out why incense is so strong. But we stewed in our own juices, literally that way. And I'm not saying that's necessary, but it's natural. You know, we're in our body. Is it our body? Well, we don't know. But we seem to locate ourselves. We can't deny it. And our body secretes stuff. Our body digests stuff. Our body breathes. Our lungs are moist and gooey. Our intestines are uptight. It affects how we think. How are we in our body? What is the locus of our suffering and our resistance in our body, in our breath? Always close. Always close. Gathering white duckweed on the tranquil lake. The day turns to dusk in the South China Spring, in the Neptune Spring. On the River Dong, there's a returning traveler. This being 8th century China, he meets an old acquaintance on the Suxiang, which is a river. So we are our own old acquaintance. We meet ourselves right here. Gathering white duckweed on the tranquil lake. The day turns to dusk in the South China Spring. We sit here before dusk, before dawn, in the darkness. We begin to hear the birds, the transformation of the light, the transformation of the morning, and it's all tied up also with the experience of our resistance, or our pleasure, or our sensations, our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our body, our mind. We're all the changing light. On the River Dong, there's a returning traveler. The River Dong, our breath. I'm making this up. This isn't like canon. It wasn't, you know, written in a book by some Zen guy 1,000 years ago. So maybe it's not true. Excuse me. What is the river of our breath? Where does it go? The returning traveler, the one who's been out and about, comes back. Comes back. And he meets an old acquaintance. She meets an old acquaintance. Oh, are you the guy who was so violent and aggressive? No. Are you the guy? Are you the gal? That is me. Everywhere I go, I see him. He is me, but I am not him. That's some interpretation of a Dong Chang's enlightenment poem. Who are we? Who is breathing? Who is feeling pain? where do we go from here? Sitting still, following the schedule, doing these rituals. We're not worshiping Buddha. Buddha isn't out there. It makes this river available. This practice makes this river of self, not self. This river of emptiness. This river of gratitude. This river of generosity. Available. This is what's been given to us. That's Jifeng, Shishuang, Saoshan, Dongshan, even Chan Master Boning Yang. This is their gift to us. And this is where we meet them, on this river. And they're dead. And soon we will be. Will we provide a boat for people to travel on the river? Where is the technique to help people? It's right here. Mm-hmm. So, let's get in our raft together. Mm-hmm. And continue our practice together. As best we can, stay with that resistance. If we don't have resistance, that's okay. You don't have to have resistance.
Good.
But when it comes, it's an old friend. So.
All Buddha's ten directions